And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for over 5 months, titled The 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled At the Drop of a Cat. Then it's The Sun Egg, the one about the blackbird, On the Air with Dr. Doodlebug, helping bugs one call at a time, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with If You Live Here. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled At the Drop of a Cat. I turned 6 this year, and I'm learning to read and write. I really like it. I practice at Lewis's house. He's my grandpa. He takes care of me a lot, every Wednesday and on Sundays, too. He lives in a little house he built himself, surrounded by a garden, bursting with incredible fruits and vegetables. The garden feels like a whole other world. Whenever it's nice outside, I sit out there at a little wooden table with my pencils and notebook. My mom says Lewis has a green thumb. The minute he plants a seed in the ground, it sprouts right up. His green beans climb all the way to the sky, and his artichokes grow as big as heads. And his leeks line up like a row of soldiers. I've never seen anything like it, says Mom. All the other gardeners are jealous of Lewis and his garden. Lewis likes to say, the earth is my mother. Lewis speaks bird language. When he talks to the chickadees, they talk back. He knows all the garden birds by name. He's taught me oriole, chickadee, robin, sparrow, nightingale, starling. Lewis talks with his cat, too. Her name is Diabola. They don't always agree. Lewis isn't from here. He has an accent because he's from Spain. He walked here all by himself when he was 11 years old. He crossed mountains and hills and the countryside until he got to France. He was running away from a terrible war. Dad told me Lewis didn't have a chance to be a kid. He never went to school. When he was my age, he was already working hard in the fields. He never learned how to read or write, not even his name. There aren't any books or newspapers anywhere in his house. The walls are covered with pictures of flowers and animals he drew himself. Sometimes we draw together in the garden. His drawings are always better than mine. Dad says Lewis is as good as Henri Rousseau, and he is a really famous painter. The other day, I got out my notebook and started writing. Lewis leaned over my shoulder, watching me draw my letters. "Want me to teach you?" I asked him. "Oh, it's a little late for me to learn now," he sighed. "My head is tired." I love the way Lewis talks. He's always saying, "At the drop of a cat." And now I say it all the time, too. It means right away. Without delay. The other day at school, my teacher corrected me. We say, at the drop of a hat. I wanted to explain why I liked cat better, but I didn't end up saying anything. Lewis spent a lot of time working on construction sites when he was young. He didn't have a house, so he slept in camper trailers. I think I'd like living in a camper trailer. I'd feel like I was always on vacation. Another thing about Lewis is that he is such a great cook. There's always something baking or simmering, so his house smells good. He says I am the apple of his pie, which means he really likes me. Or I am the apple of his eye, if you are my teacher. We like to go to the meadow together and pick wild plants. Some are safe to eat, but be careful. Some are poisonous. You can't learn how to tell the difference from a book, so Lewis shows me. A wild carrot smells good, like a carrot should. Hemlock looks like a carrot too, but smells like a stinky dead mouse. If a cow eats even a little bit, it won't live through the night. My grandpa has tattoos all over his arms. A rose, a knife, a mermaid, a boat. Memories from when he was young. I daydream about his tattoos and draw them in my notebook. One day Lewis said, back then, no one messed with me. When I was 20, fighting didn't scare me. He was digging with a spade and wearing an undershirt, the sleeveless kind he calls my Marcel. I told him I'd really like a Marcel too. The very next Sunday, he found one for me at the market. As soon as I put it on, I look like a tough guy. Whenever it's nice outside, Lewis sings and plays his guitar under the cherry tree. The birds sing back to him. Diabola rubs her head against his hand while he strums the strings. It makes me laugh. She's always doing that. It doesn't bother Lewis at all. He loves cats. I sing with him in Spanish, even though I don't understand all of it. It's a song about women, hearts, and butterflies. Corazón Mariposa. I like these words a lot. One day at the end of the school year, I read a poem out loud to him. Two whole pages. The Cat and the Bird by Jacques Prévert. It was June, and the cherry tree was loaded with black cherries. The birds wouldn't stop stealing the fruit, and Diabola was dreaming of catching a bird. You did it! You can read and write, my grandpa said. He got up and came back with an enormous package. A guitar, just for me. I tried it out. Zing, zing. I was on top of the world. Lewis showed me how to play a few chords. It's a little big for you now, he said, but don't worry. Your fingers will grow. The Sun Egg. There was once a small elf who lived in a hollow tree in the woods. She loved dancing. In the spring, she danced a welcome back sun dance. In the autumn, a swirling yellow leaves dance. And in the winter, a falling snow dance. She would dance until she was so tired that she would crawl into her tree and fall asleep. In the summer, there was so much happening and so many interesting, funny things to watch that she didn't have so much time for dancing. All the birds in the wood were her friends. If she saw an egg that had fallen out of its nest, lying on the moss, she would carry it up to the mother bird as quickly as she could. The birds were all very fond of her, and they sang their most beautiful songs whenever she was near. One day, when she was exploring in the wood, the elf saw something large, round, and orange lying on the ground. What a big egg, she thought. Where has it come from, I wonder? She looked up and saw a bright hole in the clouds overhead. I know, she said, the sun has dropped an egg, and she can't see it because the cloud's in the way. And the little elf ran off straight away to tell her friend, Larch, all about it. Larch was lying on a branch. He was always playing tricks on people, and when he saw her, he threw down a fir cone, and it tripped her up.
"You are mean," said the elf crossly, picking herself up. "I'll tell Crooked Root if you do that again."
Crooked Root was the old gnome in charge of the woods, and he was the only person Larch was afraid of.
"Telltale," called Larch. "Well, maybe I won't then," said the elf, "but I shan't tell you my secret. So there."
And she ran off. Larch jumped down from his tree and ran after her. He picked up a grass straw and a pointed stick to give her a drink of fresh birch sap, because he wanted to make it up with her again, although really he wasn't supposed to tap the birch trees. Crooked Root had forbidden it. The elf went straight to Happy Frog, who lived by the lake. Happy Frog laughed at everything. She had a little restaurant, which was also called the Happy Frog. When the elf came running up, a snail and a lizard were having lunch, and Happy Frog's friend, Anxious Frog, was waiting to be served.
"What would you like, fresh bleak roe or chopped pond weed?" asked Happy Frog. "Or would you rather have some plantain seed?"
"Oh, no, thank you. I couldn't eat a thing. I've already had a whole wood sorrel leaf this morning," said the elf. "But I do have some very important news. The sun has laid an egg, and it's fallen into our wood. Come and look."
Happy Frog thought this was so funny that she collapsed into giggles and almost choked. Anxious Frog had to slap her on the back. The elf ran ahead to show the way, and the others followed. Larch came running up with his friend, the squirrel. They were all very surprised and not a little puzzled when they saw the elf's egg.
"Just think," said the elf, "if it hatches out soon, we'll have our own sun shining here in the wood."
"Oh, I certainly hope not," said the owl, peering down from his tree. "I would have to move. To wit, to who?"
"Well, it'll be very hot in the middle," said Larch. "The sun has a fire inside, you know."
Just then, old Crooked Root came hobbling up.
"What's going on here?" he asked.
"It's a sun egg," said Larch.
"To wit, to who?"
"The wood go up in flames soon," said the owl.
"We must stop that straight away," said Crooked Root.
"Well, the best thing would be if it..."
"Ha, ha, ha, ha," said Happy Frog. She meant to say that they ought to hatch it out in the stream. But when she thought how funny it would look, hissing under the water, she couldn't stop laughing.
"Nothing to laugh at," said Crooked Root crossly. "Everyone lend a hand. We'll roll the egg down to the water."
"Well, the shell isn't very warm," said the lizard, sniffing it gingerly.
"Hooray!" shouted Larch. "It isn't a sun egg. It's a ball."
And he gave it a kick.
"Don't kick my sun egg. You'll hurt the sun chick," cried the elf.
But Crooked Root had already seized Larch by the ear.
"You touch that sun egg again, and you'll get what for," he said.
Suddenly, Squirrel bit off a piece of shell and scurried up a tree with it.
"Ugh," he said, "it tastes horrible." "Do be careful with my sun egg," cried the elf.
and a chaffinch heard her and came flying up to see what was the matter.
"Listen," said the cowfinch, "that isn't a sun egg. It's a kind of sun fruit called an orange. You see hundreds of them. So I hear, in the sunny countries where some of us fly during the winter, there are as many of them as cones on a fir tree, and they have a lovely sweet juice in them."
"Juice, did you say?"
cried Larch, and he darted behind the orange ball. He made a hole in the skin with his sharp pointed stick, put in his straw, and sucked.
"Oh, it is good," he said, and he licked his lips. "Oh, I've never tasted anything so delicious."
"What have you done?"
shouted Crooked Root angrily. Larch quickly passed his straw to the old gnome so he could have a taste too. Then he got straws for the others, and soon they were all standing around the great ball sucking and saying,
"Oh, how lovely!"
Happy Frog had less than anyone else because Larch tickled her ribs and the juice went down the wrong way. When she had finished choking, she said, "Listen, little elf, you can eat free for a whole year if you'll let me have this juice barrel for my restaurant." At that moment, a huge black crow came flying past, flapping his wings and cawing loudly. Everyone was scared. Suddenly, he swooped down and snatched the orange in his claws and flew off with it to his nest. The baby crows opened their beaks wide, but the crow was too greedy to let them have any. He just swallowed the orange whole, but it stuck in his throat and almost choked him. Afterwards, his neck was so sore that he had to be bandaged all summer, and he couldn't caw again, which rather served him right, the greedy thing. The little elf burst into tears when she saw the crow disappearing with her orange.
"Don't cry, little elf," said the mistle thrush. "If you like, you can come with me this autumn to the sunny southern country where the ripe oranges hang on trees. You are so light, you could easily ride on my back." When she heard this, the elf's face lit up, and she danced all through the wood, singing,
"I'm going to the land of the sun. I'm going to the land of the sun."
When autumn came, the elf did go south with the mistle thrush. She ran about happily in the sunshine, and soon she was nearly as good friends with the butterflies there as she was with the ones in her own wood. Whenever she was hungry, she stuck a straw into a big orange and took a drink of fresh juice. But the lemons were much too sour, so she never drank from them. So if one day you find an orange that is a bit dry, don't get too cross. Perhaps the elf has been drinking from it, and I'm sure you wouldn't mind if she had a sip or two of your juice. Although the elf loved the warm southern country, she would say to the sun nearly every day,
"Sun, please hurry up and shine on the woods at home so that spring will be there again soon."
Because when spring came, she was going back home with the mistle thrush. She had promised to return because the wood anemones would not come out unless she was there to dance her welcome back sun dance. Crooked Root and Larch were longing to see her. Again and again, they went to see if the mistle thrush had returned, and Crooked Root would say,
"Don't be silly, of course. The mistle thrush won't come back in the middle of winter."
But even when the snow was on the ground, he would look too all the same. When at last the elf did come home, everyone was so pleased that they ran round her, laughing and turning somersaults. But the whole story really began a long time before, when a small boy called Danny went looking for wild strawberries in the wood and dropped an orange out of his picnic box. The one about the blackbird. For as long as he could remember, Jack had lived in a house that was alive with music. "Listen to this one," his grandfather would say, putting a record on his turntable. The record would spin and fill up the room with songs so alive that Jack could almost see the notes dancing in the air. His grandfather was as full of music as his records. He could play drums and keyboards and the trumpet and saxophone. But Jack liked it best when he played songs on his guitar, especially when he played the one about the blackbird. "I want to do that," Jack whispered to his grandfather that night as he tucked him in. "I want to make those sounds." He was afraid his grandfather would say he was too young to make music, but his grandfather smiled. "I always knew you had music in you," he said. The first thing Jack heard when he woke up the next morning was his grandfather strumming his guitar and playing Jack's favorite song, the one about the blackbird. "Can you teach me that?" Jack asked, rubbing his eyes and settling down beside his grandfather, watching as his fingers danced across the guitar strings. "Someday," his grandfather said, "but let's start with something a little easier." He passed his guitar to Jack, who took it with shaking hands. He ran his fingers down the neck, feeling the soft wood worn smooth from years of playing. "Hold it like this," his grandfather told him. He helped Jack balance the guitar on his lap. It felt big and awkward and nothing like Jack had expected. He struck the strings wildly, almost dropping the guitar at the loud, tuneless brong that honked out of the instrument. His grandfather laughed. "Slow down," he said, and he placed Jack's right hand on the neck. "Now try." Jack tried, but his fingers refused to stay in position. His grandfather moved them back into shape, and Jack tried again, but again his fingers immediately slid off the strings. "I can't do it. It's too hard," he said, pushing the guitar back toward his grandfather. "Well, if it was easy, everyone would do it," his grandfather said kindly. "Keep trying." Jack frowned, but took the guitar back and let his grandfather move his fingers onto the strings. He took the pick in his left hand and strummed. This time, the guitar sang. He strummed again. "I'm doing it," he yelled. Jack strummed and strummed until his fingers burned. Then he put his grandfather's guitar back into its case. The next day, his grandfather taught him another chord, and then another. Jack practiced and practiced, strumming the guitar and memorizing chords every day, until one morning he noticed that his fingers didn't hurt when he pressed down on the strings, and he could play entire songs without stopping between each chord. Time passed, as time tends to do, and as Jack got bigger, the guitar got smaller. And there he is. He's hugging him and sending him off on a bus. Jack went from playing the guitar in his living room to playing for crowds of people all over the world. But no matter how busy he got or how far he traveled, when he missed home, he took out his grandfather's records and played them, especially the one about the blackbird. "I like your guitar," his grandfather told him one day when Jack visited, reaching over to run his gnarled fingers over the smooth, well-worn wood. "It was yours," Jack said, smiling. He handed the guitar to his grandfather. It looked large in his grandfather's lap. "Hold it like this," Jack told him. His grandfather's hand moved up the neck, a flicker of something flashing across his face. "I think I remember this," Jack's grandfather said. "Can you show me?" Jack moved his grandfather's fingers into position. He struck the strings, then frowned. "It's too hard," he said. "If it was easy, everyone would do it," Jack told him. His grandfather nodded, like he had heard those words before. He bent his fingers into shape against the strings, but didn't strum. "You play," he said, so Jack did. "I know that song," his grandfather smiled, tapping his foot in time to the music. "That's the one about the blackbird." On the air with Dr. Doodlebug, helping bugs one call at a time. Broadcasting live from Studio B, you are on the air with Dr. Doodlebug. This is Natalie Natt inviting you stingers and wingers to the call-in show where curious bugs ask the questions and Dr. Doodlebug supplies the answers. Thank you, Natalie. And hey, all you bugs out there, you can live stream us, watch our webcast, or give us a buzz. Our first question comes from a caterpillar named Moni.
"You help, Dr. Doodlebug. I can't stop eating. All day long I munch on milkweed. This morning I woke up with a strange urge to hang upside down and spin myself into a sack. How weird is that?"
"Hello, Moni. It's not weird. It's wonderful. You are just like thousands of other caterpillars who have the same urge." "That urge is part of a process called metamorphosis. Here's how it works. First, you'll need a cozy spot. That's where you'll hang upside down. Next, you will make a little greenhouse called a pupa, using the food you munched on. Don't forget, Moni, you started your life as a tiny egg."
"Wow, what will happen then?"
"And then, when you're ready, you'll come out a beautiful monarch butterfly." Our next question comes from a guy with a big stink. Sammy Stinkbug, you're on the air.
"Yeah, Doc, you gotta help me. I can't seem to make any friends. I stink. I just stink."
"Well, Sammy, you are a stink bug, and there's nothing you can do about that smell."
"Nothing?"
"No, but that stink is your superpower."
"Da da da da. My superpower?"
"Yes, Sammy. You use that stink to defend yourself. That stench ruins the appetite of any predator that has you on its menu. Well, it comes from tiny holes in your abdomen and gets released when you feel threatened."
"Let's get stinky."
"Just spray any bats or spiders that want to eat you or your friends for breakfast and poof, they're gone. Every bug wants a friend like that." Our next question comes from an adventurous ant.
"Hi, Doctor. My name is Antonio, and I'm lost. All I wanted was to go on an adventure and discover the forest floor around me.
but now I can't find my way back home.
Antonio, you're in luck. Every ant's body creates and leaves a scent whenever they go. The scent, which comes from the food you eat, is called a pheromone.
So you mean I can sniff the ground and retrace my steps? Whew, I made it back to my nest. What an adventure. Thank you, Dr. Doodlebug.
Flash. Hiya, Dr. Doodlebug.
We were listening to your show on our way to a flash mob, and we had a question about helping the environment. We're trying to reduce our carbon footprint, but we are lightning bugs. Doesn't that mean we use electricity?
No, you are not electric at all.
Really?
Yeah, unlike humans, who light up the night sky using electricity, you light up the sky in a 100% energy-efficient way. And it's completely natural. A chemical called luciferin mixes with the oxygen in your belly to create a glow. That means you are not using any electricity. No electricity means no heat. No heat means no greenhouse gases. No greenhouse gases means no carbon footprint.
Wow, what a bright way to end the show. So bright, I had to put on my shades.
Well, that's it for our show, all you stingers and wingers. We'll see you next time with On the Air with Dr. Doodlebug. Gotta fly.
And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for over 5 months, titled The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter, one moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with 2 hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in the 57 bus, author Daishika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. This true story, first chronicled in the New York Times Magazine by Slater and artfully, compassionately, and expertly expanded upon here, is a riveting exploration of race, class, gender, identity, morality, and forgiveness, told with honesty and insight gleaned from both teens' lives. The 57 Bus will inspire you to rethink all you know about crime, punishment, and empathy. Okay, last week we learned Sasha's parents, Debbie and Carl, they read a victim impact statement letter. They said that hatred leads to hate and didn't want Richard to come out of prison full of hate. They also feel bad for Richard's mom, Jasmine. Carl said Richard looks like a kid. Debbie said she hopes he doesn't get crushed. Sasha now attends college at MIT and is living in a fraternity. Debbie and Carl's family received the letters that were written by Richard 14 months earlier. Debbie said she wouldn't have given the same speech at sentencing if she had read those letters. Richard is now transferred to the Youth Correctional Facility, known as CHAD, in Stockton, California. And that's where I left off last week. Then and now. 10 years ago, California had 10,000 incarcerated juveniles in 11 state facilities and 6 camps. Today, the number hovers around 700, distributed among 3 facilities and 1 conservation camp, where low-risk youths do fire suppression work. Only hardcore offenders come to Division of Juvenile Justice facilities, kids convicted of violent crimes and sex offenses. Youths convicted of less serious crimes serve their time in county juvenile halls or group homes, or by remaining in the community while wearing GPS ankle monitors that track their movements. Most of the young people in DJJ facilities were tried in juvenile court, as those who go through adult court usually wind up in adult prisons. Offenders who come here generally stay 2 or 3 years. CHAD has 12 living units, only 9 of which are currently being used. They are arranged in a semicircle around a scrubby grass expanse where the youths play softball, touch football, soccer. It's blistering hot in the summer, bleaky cold in the winter. The views are dreary. A bare brown hill, a chain-link fence, searchlights stacked on a pole. Yet despite the horrid weather, the squat sameness of the buildings, and the severity of the youth's offenses, CHAD doesn't feel like a terrible place. The atmosphere is relaxed and informal, more like a school than a prison. Youths go to class, attend vocational programs, work at on-site jobs, take part in cognitive behavioral counseling groups. They complain about being tired from work and from school, but they don't complain about being bored. 10 years ago, CHAD was a very different place. In August 2005, an 18-year-old named Joseph Daniel Maldonado hung himself with a bedsheet from the upper bunk of his room at CHAD's Pario Hall. He had spent the previous 8 weeks confined to his room close to 24 hours a day and had been denied mental health services despite his repeated request. It was the 5th suicide at a California juvenile facility in as many years. Back then, California's juvenile facilities were notoriously harsh, violent, dilapidated, dull, and overcrowded, with young wards routinely subjected to solitary confinement, and some forced to exercise and attend classes while locked in cages. Use of physical force and psychotropic drugs were rampant. Violence hung about the place like a bad smell. Classes were frequently canceled due to a shortage of teachers. Jobs were hard to come by, and vocational programs were minimal. Correctional officers had the power to punish young inmates by adding time to their sentences, with the result that California's juveniles were locked up almost 3 times longer than the national average. Even once they were released, California youths seemed unable to escape from the prison's grasp. More than 80% returned to state custody within 3 years of getting out. A 2003 lawsuit, Farrell versus Harper, led to wholesale reform. This is not a system that needs tinkering around the edges. This is a system that is broken almost everywhere you look, a panel of state-approved correctional experts concluded in 2006. Later that year, the panel issued a plan for the complete restructuring of California's juvenile facilities. It took time and continual pressure from reformers to implement the plan. But in fewer than 10 years, California's juvenile facilities went from being some of the worst in the nation to some of the best. They don't throw people in the hole very much. The violence is way down. The satisfaction of the staff and the kids is way up, says Don Spector, executive director of the nonprofit Prison Law Office, which filed the original lawsuit in 2002. And has been tracking the state's progress ever since. It's a totally different place. Instead of focusing exclusively on punishing bad behavior, staff now tracks and reward good behavior. Youths get positive checks for complying with the rules, but also for using the interpersonal skills necessary to do well on the outside. Skills like asking for help, or talking through a conflict. Behave well all day, and you can stay an hour later in the common areas instead of having to return to your room at 8 p.m. Do well all week, and you snag candy, chips, or soda from the incentive locker. A month of good behavior wins you an invitation to a pizza or nacho party. And if you do well for long enough, you can apply for a week-long stay in one or two incentive rooms, cells, that have been converted into mini man caves with DirecTV, video game consoles, comfy, colorful bedding, and, of critical importance, in slightly hot Stockton, a fan. Risky thinking. Let me ask you, Ricky Lindsay said, do you have risky thoughts going on throughout your day? Lindsay, a parole agent at Chad, was addressing Richard and a half dozen other young men in a small meeting room inside Chad's Feather Hall, the living quarters for the facility's lowest risk, best behaving youths. It was late afternoon. The young inmates had completed school and work for the day. Now they had just one more obligation before dinner. Counterpoint, a cognitive behavioral program designed to teach problem solving and perspective taking. Fear of getting in trouble, offered a young man in a white t-shirt. He tipped his chair back against the whiteboard behind him. The room, bare except for an easel, wasn't much larger than a walk-in closet. Richard sat quietly, elbows on his knees, listening. What would get you in trouble, though? Lindsay asked. He was a general fireplug of a man who spoke informally, like someone from the neighborhood. Like behavior. What kind of behavior gets you in trouble? Anger. What makes you angry? Rage. What makes you rageful? Come on. Disrespect. When you feel disrespected, how does that make you feel? It hurts. It hurts? What does it make you want to think? My feelings be like wanting me to react, the young man said. Justification, another youth offered. He had short hair, and his confident manner signaled that he'd been around a while. Why would that go to risky thinking? Most people don't think before they act, the youth with glasses explained. I think, but with that thinking, I still try to justify what I'm going to do. I'm a little stubborn with my thinking. Lindsay nodded as if to say, now we're getting there. Risky thinking, he said. All of you are here for a reason, right? I'm going to say that all of you are here because of some risky thoughts you had. Maybe I shouldn't have went to the store that night. Maybe I shouldn't have jacked that guy that night. Maybe I shouldn't have had a fight with that guy that night, right? Maybe I shouldn't have had that pistol on me that night, right? Just saying. Or is it because you didn't think about it? Another kid suggested. He wore a black windbreaker and had a sardonic edge to him. It could be, Lindsay agreed. Other guys be under the influence. Not being fully aware of your surroundings can be a risky thinking because you're not in your right state of mind. How do you know it's a risky thought? Doubt, said a youth whose hair was pulled back in a ponytail. He leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees, his eyes on Lindsay. Doubt, Lindsay repeated. Explain. Well, when your conscience tells you it's bad, you know it ain't supposed. You ain't supposed to do it. Your conscience, Lindsay said, that little angel and that little devil. And you listen to the bad one, the ponytail kid said. The good one is the one you're supposed to listen to. The good one is the one that basically, that's you. The good one is giving you that gut feeling, offered the kid with the black framed glasses. He's saying, you sure that's the right thing to do? Lindsay agreed. So you got a good dude and a bad dude. Which one are you going to listen to? I think I got two bad dudes, said the boy in the black windbreaker. He grinned. Lindsay laughed. It's different for everybody. He handed out a sheet of paper listing different kinds of risky thinking. Overgeneralizing? What's that? You always blame it on me, the kid with the glasses said, playing the role of the overgeneralizer. Staff always trying to get me. You always give me negative checks. Lindsay nodded. There you go. He ran through some other categories. Catastrophizing. That was one kid's grandma. Always sure the worst was going to happen. Desperate and deserving. You're like, I need this, or I have a right to this, somebody offered. Uh-oh. Lindsay said. Sort of entitlement, someone else suggested. Man, why can't I ever have this? Ah, Lindsay raised his eyebrows, asking for more. Ain't I a good person? Don't I deserve to have this? Man, I've been working this job for 5 years. I still don't have this. A discussion ensued. Was desperate and deserving? Just a way that poor people thought. Rich people can't be desperate and deserving. What are you talking about? One kid scoffed. They can be hella rich, and they can be like, I deserve to have a wife. And you start to feel hella bad for yourself, the ponytailed kid said. Like some people got so much money, but they don't have nobody. Yeah, but I'd rather be them than be here, the sardonic kid said. He folded his arms across his chest. Everybody nodded. Progress report. Sasha stood in the hallway outside Department 11, wearing a vest, button-up shirt, and bow tie, paired with a long skirt and ballet flats. Over their shoulder, they had slung a canvas purse decorated with pins. LGBTQ Class of 2018, read one. Another said simply, they, them, there. They'd cut their hair short and shaved it on one side. The ends were dyed fluorescent pink. Debbie and Carl stood beside Sasha. They, too, were dressed in their courtroom best, a purple jersey dress for Debbie, pleated slacks, a pink checkered shirt, and a tie for Carl. Carl had topped his outfit with his Outback hat, the same one he'd used to cover Sasha the day Sasha was burned. It was the last Friday in June 2015. The family had come to court for Richard's second progress report, the one that would determine whether he was eligible for resentencing. Richard had passed the first hurdle with flying colors. He had had no disciplinary violations, and the staff at CHAD had described him as motivated to participate in treatment programs and remorseful about his crime. If his second progress report was equally positive, he could be resentenced to 5 years instead of 7. The elevator opened and Jasmine stepped out, wearing jeans and high tops and a black and white Shaw collared jacket. She hugged all three members of Sasha's family and took a seat, exhaling sharply. The strain was gone from her face, and she was smiling, but she was tired too, having recently taken on a second job. After completing her shift at the convalescent home, she now worked a 4-hour shift at the supermarket, often not getting off work until 1 a.m. Every Sunday, she drove 3 hours round trip to visit Richard. Getting the time off to come to court hadn't been easy. Her boss had turned down her request, but she had managed to quietly trade shifts with a co-worker. Now there was another problem. Richard's court file had somehow been misplaced, which meant that the judge couldn't review the record. The case would have to be continued until the following week. Jasmine's shoulders slumped. "I can't get more time off," she whispered. She kept talking for a moment, but then her voice trailed off. "I'm smiling, but I'm crying inside," she admitted. She was cycling through the options in her mind. How could she get there? Who else could come? Well, the case file mishap wasn't just a problem for Jasmine. Sasha's family wanted to address the court, but they were leaving for vacation the next day. They wouldn't be around next week. After some discussion, Judge DeLucci agreed to let them make their statement. He beckoned Carl to the front of the room. The parties now stood before the judge like a couple standing before the altar. Carl, with Deputy District Attorney Scott Ford at his side, Richard with Bill DuBois. In the year and a half since it all began, Richard had grown taller than DuBois, his shoulders broader. He watched Carl, his expression neutral. Carl cleared his throat and unfolded a sheet of paper. "I am speaking on behalf of my wife, Debbie, and our child, Sasha. Thank you for the opportunity to have our voices heard," he began. The courtroom fell silent. In the week following the fire on the bus, Richard wrote 2 letters to Sasha in which he took full responsibility for his actions and asked for forgiveness. Unfortunately, it took 14 months for those letters to reach us. When we finally read them, we were moved to tears. The letters gave us a clearer picture of who Richard is, and we wished we had been able to see them before Debbie spoke at the sentencing hearing. As he listened, Richard's jaw worked, the muscles tensing and relaxing, his lips pulled to one side. "I believe Richard when he says he meant no bodily harm to Sasha," Carl continued. "But I also believe that Sasha would not have been a target if Sasha had been wearing jeans." He described how other kids on the bus had laughed even as Sasha's clothes went up in flames. "We wish for Richard and those other kids to learn empathy toward those who are different. We hope that there are programs in juvenile detention that can at least help Richard with this, and that he can become an ally who will stand up against the bullying and hatred of gay and trans people." It was so quiet in the courtroom that you could hear the flutter of Carl's breath as he tried to steady his voice. "From the start, we have been opposed to Richard's being tried as an adult," he said. "His actions appear to have been impulsive, immature, and unpremeditated. He did make a big mistake and recognized that. He asked for our forgiveness. Carl's voice broke. Sasha, Debbie, and I have forgiven Richard, he whispered. We hope the state will focus more on preparing him for the world beyond incarceration than on punishing him. When Carl raised his eyes from the paper, clenched in his hands, he saw Richard watching him. Thank you, Richard mouthed. At the back of the courtroom, the ladies were red-eyed and sniffling. Given that the sentence allows the court a pretty fair amount of discretion, I do not take your words lightly, Judge DeLucci said. Then he continued the case to the following Tuesday. A level of maturity. The record should reflect that the court has read the fairly voluminous records that have been provided, Judge DeLucci said, when Richard returned to court the next week. It was a positive report, the judge noted. Richard was attending school, participating in treatment, and had expressed interest in getting a job at the facility. He hadn't had any disciplinary actions. The staff noted that he was reserved and quiet and tended to keep to himself, but they commended him on limiting his interactions so that he is not drawn into too much negativity. All in all, DeLucci told Richard the report indicated a level of maturity that you didn't exhibit on the day of the offense. In addition, he continued, Sasha's family has made it clear what their position is, and that should be considered. With that, he modified Richard's sentence from 7 years to 5 years, with credit for time served. He would be out before his 21st birthday. It was his recommendation that Richard serve the totality of that time in the juvenile system. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue and possibly finish the book, The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.